Life and Times of the Socialist Standard. Right, what I'm going to do is start by trying to give an insight into some aspects of the kind of writing that's characterized the pages of the Socialist Standard over the years, and then go on to talk about the rationale and the writing of a column I've been doing myself for the Standard in recent times, called Life and Times. It should take about half an hour, by the way. I'll start by saying that in my own early years in the party, I was writing pretty regularly for the Standard, something I've not always done since. But at one point during that early period, I had an idea, and that was to do a regular column with the overall sort of with the strap line, if you like, of the street where I live. Don't remember if I mentioned it to the editors at the time, but the idea in my head was to write articles that would talk about things happening in my local area that illustrated how capitalism worked and how these things reflected and shaped people's attitudes and actions. And then I would draw conclusions from that about the way the system worked as a whole and how things could work differently in a socialist society. Now, I say it was an idea, and in fact, that's all it was, and because for one reason or another, it never actually got off the ground. However, the idea did remain in my head, and something happened relatively recently that sort of brought it to life again. It started in 2020, the lockdown year. Around that time, after a long period when I'd not written much at all for the Standard, I started doing some reviews of books I was reading. During the lockdown itself, this accelerated, largely because one of the limited number of activities I was still free to engage in was ordering books and then reading them and then writing about them. I also started to write a few other things for the Standard that weren't book reviews. And after the lockdown, I carried on with that. And towards the end of the following year, so we're talking about 2021, a member of the Socialist Standard Production Committee asked me if I'd consider writing a regular monthly column for the back page of the Standard, which would take over from the existing one, which had been going on for a number of years, under a title I always found slightly amusing, Rear View. Some members may remember that before that there'd been other long-standing back page columns, for example, Voice from the Back. And before that, there was Sting in the Tail. Anyway, after some reflection, I agreed. And ever since then, so over a 3-year period, each month, I've managed to supply a back page article for the Standard. And a bit to my surprise, despite the fears I had when I first agreed to do it, I've not struggled too much with it. But I'll come back to that a bit later. So once I'd agreed to take on that job, the question was, what would the overall title of the page, the column, call it what you like, what would it be, the one that was going to succeed Rear View, Voice from the Back, and Sting in the Tail? Well, my immediate thought was, why not resurrect the street where I live? But that didn't seem too popular with the committee, and its members made one or two other suggestions. One I remember was acid socialism, which I didn't particularly like, largely because I didn't really know what it meant. Another one was Life and Times. So the title wasn't actually my idea, but I did like that, and I agreed to go with it. And it seemed to me that it could actually include the kind of thing I'd had in mind all those years ago, the street where I live idea, but it could also reach wider, and I'll explain that a bit more later. Anyway, as I've said, the result has been that over the past 3 years, I've managed to turn out a regular monthly piece for the back page of the Standard, and it's been under that rubric, Life and Times. I'll say more later about the kind of thing these pieces have been and the way I've written them and where my material has come from. But before that, I want to go back and say something about the kind of writing that's featured, a few things anyway, about the kind of writing that's featured more generally in the Life and Times of the Standard as a whole. Let's say over the last sort of 50 or 60 years, and how that compares with the kind of writing we have now. Someone once characterized the party and its journal as political politics. I heard that said when I was first in the party. Well, I don't think anyone would say that today, because what that characterization expressed was a party and a journal which were heavy, well, for a start, heavy on theory, Marxist theory, of course, though the word normally used at the time was Marxian. And it also suggested a party and journal that were attached in an extremely hard-hitting way to analysing the politics of capitalism and its parties and groups, etc. But a journal that was less attached to focusing on the day-to-day details, the day-to-day reality of the system as experienced by workers. As I say, I don't think it would be fair to say that about the party today, at least not as much anyway. Marxist theory is still there, of course, though, to be fair, more thinly spread, both in the Standard and among members, than it was in the past. However, we do go full pelt, especially election times, analysing and exposing the vacuous politics of the other parties. And of course, we still never stop pointing to the class nature of capitalist society. But overall, the pages of the Standard are definitely talking more than in the past about the daily lives and experiences of workers under capitalism. And more often, they're talking about topical subjects. Just to give one or two examples of how that shift has been reflected. First of all, the Standard used to have what could be called an almost impersonal tradition of authorship, which meant that articles were not attributed to any particular writer and so remained unsigned, or for the initial or initials of the writer to be used rather than their actual name. So for decades, one of the key party theorists and writers, Edgar Hardcastle, or Hardy, as he was known in the party, simply signed himself H. And Dave Steele, an active member and writer in the late 60s and early 70s, was just S. We still have this tradition of initials to a certain extent, of course, but a good many articles do now appear under the real name of the person who's the writer. And some of those are writers who in the past used to use just their initials. And the Standard itself is, well, in my view anyway, much more what might be called reader-friendly. For example, the articles are often divided up by subheadings, some of these very clever, and there are pictures and illustrations of various kinds. And as I've said, it's more focused than before on matters of what might be called topical interest. And also on a day-to-day level, when I first joined the party, at, say, a meeting or a party conference, virtually no one referred to anyone else who was a member by other than their surname, preceded by comrade. So it was Comrade Ambridge, Comrade Darcy, Comrade Hopkins. And that has, of course, continued to a certain extent. And I'm not saying there's anything particularly wrong with that. But increasingly now, people don't hesitate to refer to other members or to address them by their first names. And that's particularly the case in the in online gatherings such as the kind that we're involved in at this moment. And on the whole, this kind of thing has, in my view, been largely positive. One other such shift in the Standard has been the use of monthly columns with specific overall bylines dealing with different aspects of life under capitalism. Examples of this do go as far back as the 1960s, when there was a regular column called The Passing Show, But then later on in the 1990s, Dave Perrin wrote a regular TV review column. And also from the mid-90s onwards, and for well over 20 years, Ralph Critchfield did his Greasy Pole column under the pseudonym of Ivan. In the 2010s, an ex-member called Steve Clayton did monthly theatre reviews. And most recently, and for close to the past 20 years, I think that's what it is anyway, we've had Paddy Shannon's broadly speaking scientific column, Pathfinders. And over the past decade or more, there's been Mike Foster's propaganda page, mainly about things on TV and other media. And in this context, I can't not mention, among articles littering in their thousands that Adam Buick has contributed over the years, his monthly Cooking the Books pieces. Another member, one who discovered the party in the mid-2010s and relatively late in his own life, Tim Hart, quickly plunged himself into party activity of various kinds. I know this because he was in my branch. He started writing regularly for the Standard and had the idea of interviewing the most long-standing members of the party with a view to capturing their experience and writing it up for the Standard. I gather the editorial committee was skeptical, but Tim had a go anyway and interviewed a member who'd been in the party, I think since the 1940s or 50s. But Tim didn't think he got much of interest out of it. And so maybe to the relief of the SSPC, he gave up on the idea. Though I personally still think it was a good one. And I know Tim Hart had other new ideas as well, which I'm sure he would have had a go at implementing if he hadn't died, sadly and unexpectedly, around 3 years ago. But to focus now on the back page, on the Life and Times column in the Standard, which has been going for the past 3 years, and so in fact is in its infancy compared to some of the others I've already mentioned. As I said, it enabled me to resurrect the street where I live idea I'd had several decades before, but to extend it to cover not just my own street or local neighbourhood, but with its more general title of Life and Times to stray outside of that. As a broad structure, I decided I'd try and begin each piece by referring to something that had recently happened to me personally, or I'd somehow been associated with. I talk about it, try and explain it in terms of how it was part of the way people's lives were conducted in capitalism, and then I'd pull some threads together and then conclude with something on how a socialist society might deal with the issues in question, or indeed how such issues might not exist at all in socialism. So quite a lot to do there in no more than 1,000 words, which is about the maximum that can be fitted on a single page of the Standard. So perhaps unsurprisingly, sometimes anyway, I found myself having to make significant cuts to my drafts of these articles to accommodate that. But anyway, I decided that the pieces would be signed with my own full name rather than with just the initials I'd sometimes used in previous writing in the Standard. And this wasn't, of course, to show off or anything like that, but just so that the articles could be seen to reflect the experiences and the thoughts of a really existing person. But what precisely was I going to write about? Well, the first piece I did, which appeared in January 2022, so not long after the end of the pandemic, was directly related in a way to that is to the COVID crisis. But it also focused on an individual I actually knew a bit anyway. It was a young woman who many years earlier had gone to school with my son. It obviously wouldn't have been appropriate for me to mention that in the article, and I didn't. It wasn't relevant. But the title I gave to the article was She Fought the Law, obviously echoing the fairly well-known song, I Fought the Law. I Fought the Law and the Law Won. The young woman in question had made the news, the local news anyway, by allowing the small independent cinema she owned and ran in the city centre to defiantly stay open during the COVID lockdown, and then to publicly plug an anti-vax line. She claimed she had the right to. She kept emphasizing her rights. Anyway, she was prosecuted for staying open and given a hefty fine. And this is what that first article was about. I won't go into too much detail here, but just to illustrate the kind of conclusion I said I was hoping articles of this kind would lead to, these were the closing few lines. Quote, "The plain fact is that in the system of society we live in, rights are not guarantees, but like all reforms instituted by that system, they are contingent and easily disposable measures. Some readers may remember the hapless right to work campaign of the 1980s, which fizzled out when it became obvious that the system that rules us does not and can never guarantee such a right. In the moneyless, wageless society of economic equality, based on free access to all goods and services, instead of rights on paper, we would have the practical fulfillment of human needs with equal access to the democratic control necessary to secure those needs, making the whole concept of rights redundant." Now, of course, I didn't here attempt to refer to the class nature of capitalist society and its critical importance to our ideas, and I haven't done that generally in these pieces, since I don't see them on the whole as the right context for it. This kind of thing is usually done anyway by other articles that appear in any given issue of the Standard. Just a personal addendum to She Fought the Law. The very woman in question actually passed my house a few weeks ago on her way to pick up one of her children at the same primary school she herself went to with my son. I happened to be standing at my front gate and she saw me. We said hello and she stopped to talk. She's an awfully nice person. I told her I'd seen her in the news recently and we had a bit of a laugh. Of course, I didn't tell her she also appeared, though not by name, on the back page of the Socialist Standard. Right, so here in this first piece was the kind of, how can I say, intimate article I thought I'd aim at. And there have been others since which have also featured friends or acquaintances. One published earlier this year and entitled Asylum Hell was about a wedding I was invited to by an African asylum seeker I'd assisted in his endeavours to be allowed to stay in Britain. After an enormous struggle, he managed to get permission to get leave to remain by the so-called family route. He and his girlfriend had become parents and were now getting married. The article called him Francis, not his real name, and explained how I'd got to know him, how he'd managed to enroll in a higher education institution and get a first-class degree, despite knowing no English when he arrived, and the hell he then went through before he got legal status and eventually found employment, first in a DPD warehouse and then as a care worker. And this article ended in the following way. Quote, "So Francis, though it may be thought that as a care worker, he's not fulfilling his potential, he's been luckier than many in a system that divides groups of people up by borders and denies them the right to movement across the planet. Which, of course, a sane socialist society would offer. But this can only come with the abolition not just of borders and states, but of money, wages, and the whole of the profit system." Another life and time story in the early part of last year was entitled Being Homeless and involved an encounter I had with a young woman who was sat on the ground outside a local supermarket. And though she wasn't openly begging, she obviously needed money. I gave her £1 and we got talking, and she told me that until a short time before, she'd had a rented flat and a steady job in a nearby small town. Then it all turned sour. The firm she worked for folded. She couldn't pay her rent. She got evicted. And before she knew it, she was on the streets. That night, she was trying to collect money to stay in a B&B that rented rooms to homeless people for £25 a night. She told me there was another cheaper place, but the people there were always either very drugged or potentially dangerous. So she was trying her best to be on her own and away from others who were on drink and drugs. And so she needed to collect enough money to go to the place that cost more. In all this, Crean, that was her name, Crean, made no effort to ask for any more than the pound I'd already given her. She was polite, well-spoken, and definitely not deliberately trying to make you feel sorry for her. In the article, I went on to talk about how charities and homelessness were an integral feature of capitalism, and how after that encounter, I realized I should have actually given her the £25 she needed. A friend I spoke to about it said I should. They said it wouldn't have broken you, and that was absolutely right. Well, okay. Anyway, I ended the piece with a short paragraph subtitled "Can't Pay, Can't Have," pointing out the fact that in capitalism, people can find themselves denied even the most basic necessities, and how powerfully free and sitting in the cold and rain outside the Sainsbury's local brought that home. Just one more example of a personal encounter as a spur to one of these pieces, one entitled The Good, the Bad and the Ugly, which appeared in the December 2022 Standard. It came from some local leafleting a group of us were doing. We were putting leaflets through doors, and at one point a door opened and someone came out having picked up the leaflet, glanced at it, and proceeded to issue a kind of challenge along the lines of, "You lot don't know how lucky you are." Couldn't we see that things had improved massively over the years since the time, as he put it, he'd been a kid? Conversation was friendly, but it didn't last long. But as afterwards, I thought, yes, can see where he's coming from. And this led me to think that, yes, some things have improved. For example, attitudes to race and sexuality, ease of communications, readier access to goods and services, even if often on credit. But it also led me to think about things that were just as bad and haven't improved. For example, people living from one wage or salary payment to the next, dire poverty, homelessness, the need for charity and food banks, etc. And then I also thought about things that had maybe also actually got worse. Wars in so many parts of the world, people fleeing their homes, starvation and acute hunger, and even in this country, increasing material insecurity. So here I had the frame for a piece which I could call The Good, the Bad and the Ugly, and I could conveniently divide it into three sections under those headings. And having written it in that format, I then decided to add a fourth concluding section entitled The Alternative. You can probably imagine what it said, so I won't quote. But it also took the reader back to the situation the article had started with by saying, I could not, of course, say all this to the person on the doorstep, but I suppose I could hope that he clicked on the leaflet's QR code and read all about it in the Socialist Standard. No doubt wishful thinking, of course, but who knows? Now, of course, the Life and Times pieces haven't all been intimate in the sense of being sparked by a personal contact or an encounter with another person. An example of a different starting point was the February 2023 column entitled What a Contrast. It was about the American free market writer and social theorist, Ayn Rand. So on the surface here, there was a distinctly political rather than personal trigger. However, it was also sparked by a kind of personal experience that I've listening to a radio program. The program was actually a play, very good one, in fact, on Radio 4 one afternoon. It was about Ayn Rand's life. It depicted her, as she is widely known, as the ultimate advocate of laissez-faire capitalism, the purveyor of a greed is good theory of society, this seen almost as a form of moral purpose. Play showed how she'd become a kind of cult figure of American libertarianism. One historian has referred to her as the ultimate gateway drug to life on the right, and her best-known novel, Atlas Shrugged, has been called the Bible of Selfishness. But the play also had a personal dimension with regard to Ran. It showed how miserable and unsatisfactory her view of the world had made her own life and her personal relationships. Anyway, I used the first part of this Life and Times piece to try and synthesize Ran's view of the world and what underlay it. And then I explain why I'd entitled it What a Contrast. The contrast was with what had been depicted in the previous month's Life and Times column, whose title had been What an Example. That piece was about a young local car wash attendant who'd bent over backwards to help me and another fellow when our cars were involved in a minor collision outside the car wash, a genuine sort of 50-50 coming together. The attendant who was close by pulled out all the stops to help. He acted as a kind of intermediary and even sort of remedied the minor damage caused by the use of some sort of magic cream he had. He then refused to accept any payment for his help, which he was offered. For my part, I put the story on the local community Facebook site, which was then deluged with people saying positive things about the attendant. And the attendant himself came on the site, obviously feeling good about himself and enjoying the approbation of his fellow humans. Hence the title, What an Example. An example of the ultra-social bent of human beings. Just the opposite, therefore, to Rand and Randism. So what a contrast. And the Rand article ended by stressing that regardless of her politics, the ultra-social potential of humans meant that the society we advocate, based on voluntary cooperation, not competition and coercion, could work and would be so much more satisfactory for everyone than what we currently have. Just right, I was going to give one more example of a piece not based on local or close personal experience. I think I'll leave that out because I think I've sort of said it. I can perhaps mention it in questions if appropriate. And I am coming towards the end now, but just to say that I've made a point in this talk of referring explicitly to the titles of the pieces I've mentioned, because I hope you'll see I've tried to make some of them at least striking enough to capture the attention and curiosity of people picking up the standard wherever and whenever they may do so. And that would hopefully tempt them to read what comes after the title. So examples of this kind of what I'd see as striking titles, I mean, I've already mentioned a couple, She Fought the Law, The Good, the Bad and the Ugly, but some examples of others I've not mentioned this evening have been Stray Cats and Gundog Rescue, and that's about charities, not obvious, but I think it piques the imagination. Being Your Own Boss, that's probably self-explanatory. Small Change in the Small Claims, that's about the Small Claims Court. Another one was A Bit of Your Own Back, which was about shoplifting. And then there was Trump versus the Bin Man. And just a final word about the writing of these pieces. As writing goes, it isn't a very complicated process and doesn't take a particularly long time. And that, I think, is, as I've already sort of, I think, sort of alluded to, is because I'm usually writing about something I've had first-hand and probably recent experience of, and I don't often need to augment it with extra material or reading. So it comes out relatively easily. But in saying that, I'm comparing it with the other two kinds of contribution I also make to the standard. One of these is book reviews, and the other is articles on specific subjects. And actually, though it may seem counterintuitive, the hardest thing, and certainly the most time-consuming of these different kinds of things in the standard, is reviewing books. And that's because before you can start writing a review, you have to read the book. And that in itself can be a pretty long process, especially if you're making notes as you go along, as you probably need to. And then there's the effort involved in what I call choice and compression. That is putting down in a relatively small number of words what you see as the main points from a socialist point of view and drawing some kind of worthwhile conclusion not so simple. Slightly easier are other kinds of what you might call other articles of the kind you might call freestanding ones. Examples of these in recent times from me have been on Venezuela, taxing the rich, cosmetic surgery, conspiracy theories, Nordic socialism, veganism. But for all of these, I couldn't just sit down and write. I had to read up or research, as some call it, before mapping out the article and putting it together. So it's still easier than a book review, but definitely less straightforward than a Life and Times column. Right, that is just about 30 minutes. Good. Thanks very much for listening. And I hope I've done what I said I'd do at the beginning and given an insight into some aspects of the kind of writing that's peopled the pages of our marvelous journal over the years, and also into the rationale of my own Life and Times column and what drives it. It would be good to hear any ideas it might have thrown up, and above all, ideas anyone might have on how this column, or indeed other aspects of the Standard, could be changed, improved, or otherwise made more effective. Thanks very much.